For Plato, then, political decisions and policies are philosophical at their core. There can be no ideal state or just life without understanding the principles of political philosophy. And understanding these principles requires us also to understand what knowledge itself is. This need extends not only to politics, but much further. Everything that matters in human decisions or judgments depends on the difference between truth and falsity, between knowledge and ignorance. The need for making these distinctions is even more urgent because, as Plato insists, knowledge is not related only to an individual or a group. For Plato, the difference between what is true and what is false is more than a matter of subjective opinion. Plato criticizes this subjective or relativist view of knowledge and values. This view had been made popular in Athens by the Sophists, a group of itinerant teachers. The Sophists proposed to replace the certainties of religious and social traditions by a new conception of values and knowledge. According to this concept, truth and values are no more than human creations. They are not objective or natural. Certainly, they're not fixed and permanent, as Plato held. The Sophists said these things could change in any way people might decide. This was a new and startling idea for a society in which tradition was the basis for most beliefs. The Sophists are sometimes looked back at almost as revolutionaries. They were, in effect, the first humanists. They believed in the power of man to construct his own world, his own institutions, his own commitments. Plato recognized the importance of their challenge, but the challenge was a threat that needed to be opposed. For Plato, the belief that humans invent values and knowledge is both practically harmful and philosophically indefensible. The major themes of Plato's thought, including the theory of forms and his ideal republic, reflect his opposition to the Sophists. Protagoras, the most famous of them, summarized their position memorably.
Man is the measure of all things, of those things that are, that they are, and of those things that are not, that they are not.
Against this doctrine, Plato argues that knowledge and values are objective, that they are fixed independently of the knower. For Plato, knowledge and values are real in themselves. It's important to understand exactly what's entailed in the Sophists' concept of knowledge, because Plato's reaction against it is the basis of his own thinking. This dispute is, in fact, the focus of another of Plato's dialogues, the Theaetetus, named after a figure in the dialogue with whom Socrates converses. The dialogue opens, as so many of them do, with a question. What is knowledge? Socrates asks Theaetetus. And Theaetetus, like Meno, responds not with a definition, but with several examples.
I think that all the things one can learn are knowledge. Geometry and all the sciences, and then there are the crafts of the cobbler and other workmen. Each and all of these are knowledge. And nothing else.
Socrates predictably answers that he's searching not for examples, but for a definition. He chides Theaetetus.
Suppose we were asked about some obvious common thing, for instance, what clay is. It would be absurd to answer potter's clay, and oven maker's clay, and brick maker's clay.
Theaetetus quickly catches the spirit of Socrates' questioning, so quickly, in fact, that he wonders at Socrates' power as a teacher in contrast to his own pain as a student. This gives Socrates another chance to describe himself as a teacher. This time, he compares a teacher and a midwife.
My art of midwifery is in general like that of the midwives who deliver children. The only difference is that my patients are men, not women. And my concern is not with the body, but with the soul that is in travail of birth. And the highest point of my art is the power to prove by every test whether the offspring of a young man's thought is a false phantom or one that is full of life and truth. Heaven constrains me to serve as a midwife, but has debarred me from giving birth. So of myself, I have no sort of wisdom, nor has any discovery ever been born of me.
So Plato reminds us that a student must discover in himself the knowledge he seeks. Theaetetus then tries once more to answer Socrates' question.
Well, Socrates, with such encouragement from a person like you, it would be a shame not to say what one can. It seems to me, then, that one who knows something is perceiving the thing he knows. So far as I can see at present, knowledge is nothing but perception.
When Theaetetus says that knowledge seems to be perception, he's already applying his own definition. Socrates quickly associates what Theaetetus both says and does with Protagoras' claim that man is the measure of all things. Theaetetus has restated Protagoras' belief that truth is determined by the way it seems or appears to each individual. Now the chase is on. Socrates criticizes Protagoras along several tracks. The main direction of his criticism is what's known as a reductio ad absurdum argument, showing that the consequences of a statement or a position lead to absurdity. For example, Socrates contends that if Protagoras were correct in saying that each man is the measure of all things, then no one is wiser than anyone else about anything. This would mean that a layman's opinion would be as sound as a physician's about treating an illness. Someone with no special knowledge at all should have as much to say as the wine grower about planning his harvest. He should be as expert about composing music as the musician. In fact, Socrates points out, if Protagoras is correct, no one can ever be mistaken about anything.
Aren't you surprised, Theaetetus, that all of a sudden you should turn out to be as wise as any other man or any god? Must we not rather suppose that Protagoras speaks in this way to flatter the ears of the public?
If everyone's statements are equally correct, even when two people contradict each other, they must both be right. In fact, if many people say that Protagoras is mistaken when he claims that man is the measure of all things, their statement that he's mistaken would be correct. In fact, if the majority rules, then their view must be more correct than Protagoras' original statement.
Protagoras, admitting as he does that everybody's opinion is true, must acknowledge the truth of his opponent's belief about his own belief where they think he is wrong.
But would Protagoras take a vote to find out whether man is or is not the measure of all things? Socrates wonders. It's something of a mystery, in fact, why Protagoras bothered to say that man is the measure of all things at all. He could just as well say that the baboon or the pig was the measure. They too, after all, are capable of perception. If Protagoras puts people ahead of animals, he must assume that people have knowledge beyond the perception that they share in common with animals. And Protagoras can't say this without contradicting himself. Then, too, there's the irony we see when Protagoras poses as a teacher and recruits students. How can he do this if indeed everyone's opinions are equal?
If no one is entitled to say whether what another thinks is true or false, where is the wisdom of Protagoras to justify his setting up to teach others and to be handsomely paid for it? And where is our need to go and sit at his feet when each of us is himself the measure of his own wisdom?
Socrates had evidently been waiting a long time to launch this attack, but he contends that his attack is fair to Protagoras' doctrine itself. In one way, of course, Protagoras' claim makes sense. If someone says he feels a certain way, cold or warm, that statement can't be disputed. No one else can judge better than he what he feels. But to say that all claims of knowledge are like this statement leads to absurdity, according to Socrates. Socrates insists to Theaetetus that if knowledge is merely perception, it doesn't matter what the perceived object is. Indeed, objects wouldn't be objects at all in the ordinary sense of that word. They would be changing continuously into their opposites, since they would have to agree with both of the contradictory views that different people held of them.
There would be nothing constant here. A thing would not be white, but would have to be always changing into another color. We could not even give it the name of one color rather than another. And this is no more seeing a color than not seeing it.
These impossible consequences, Socrates argues, prove that Protagoras' theory and Theaetetus' own first definition of knowledge are inadequate. Knowledge may begin with perception, but it's not limited to perception. Man is undoubtedly the measure of some things, but of other things, including the most important ones, he is not. There is also one final reason in Plato's view for holding that knowledge is more than perception. Even when we speak about perception or sense experience, we say what we see or hear through the senses, not only with them. How otherwise would we coordinate the senses? How could we recognize that an object we see is indeed the same object that we touch or taste? Socrates says there must be something more at work here than the senses themselves.
Take the sound and color of a particular thing, Theaetetus. Have you not a thought which might include them both, which tells you that they belong to the same thing? Through what organ do you think all this about them? What is common to both cannot itself come to you by hearing or by sight alone, but only by a mind, or whatever it is to be called.
That mind, of course, would not be perceiving, but thinking. Socrates believes Protagoras couldn't make this distinction without contradicting himself. Theaetetus is persuaded by Socrates that whatever it is, knowledge is not merely perception. He then goes on to propose two further possibilities. The first of these is that knowledge is true opinion, a possibility that Socrates quickly addresses with a vivid analogy.
Let us suppose that every mind is a kind of aviary, stocked with birds of every sort, which stand for pieces of knowledge. When we are babies, the aviary is empty. Whenever a person acquires any piece of knowledge and puts it in the aviary, we say he has learned the things of which this is the knowledge.
But what's missing from this birdhouse is a way to explain how we are able to pick out the particular bird we want, when we want it. What is that knowledge? And so the second hypothesis, although advancing beyond the first, also fails, soon to be followed by a third and final one. In this sense, the dialogue as a whole doesn't answer the question from which it sets out. Neither Theaetetus nor the reader learns what knowledge is, but they will both have learned something about what knowledge is not. And this clearly is an important step forward for learning about anything, including knowledge. The distinction between perception and knowledge is especially crucial here. Only by distinguishing between perception and knowledge can we separate the person who has knowledge from the object of knowledge, between the knower and the known. Once this distinction is clear, the way is open also for understanding the differences between belief and knowledge, between appearance and reality. All the distinctions that are needed, Plato claims, to prove the validity of his theory of forms. We can now clarify how Socrates' arguments in the Theaetetus are related to the theory of forms as it appears in the Republic. The theory of forms fundamentally distinguishes between perception and knowledge, and it makes two basic claims related to that distinction. The first of these claims is that whatever is known must be apprehended by more than the senses. Second, the object known has to be more than just a stimulus for the senses. What knowledge is about must be independent of the knower. It must be objective. It must be real. Plato concludes from this starting point that only something like reason or the mind can know. And what the mind knows must itself be rational or intelligible. Even ordinary experience tells us what the objects of true knowledge are. We make sense of the jumble of things and of the qualities we encounter in everyday life by finding patterns or common features among them. These patterns have general names, courage, or justice, or bed. But general names would make sense only if reality itself is organized in the way that they describe. These general terms, again, correspond to the forms, the universal and objective standards which exist independently of any particular instances. The forms also are independent of space and time, in the same way that a definition exists outside the pages of any particular dictionary, and also apart from all dictionaries. The forms are necessary, according to Plato, if we're to make sense of the plurality and the confusion of the apparent world. And he concludes, we do make sense of it. To be sure, the theory of forms is itself open to a variety of objections. Plato's the first to mention many of them. In the dialogues named The Sophist and The Parmenides, Plato describes the most fundamental problems. Exactly what is the relation between the universal forms and particular things? What's the relation of the forms to each other? Do the forms themselves have the same qualities of which they are forms? For example, is redness red or courage courageous? Furthermore, Do forms exist for all things and properties, including those which can hardly be perfect, like mud or errors? These aren't merely quibbles. If the forms do exist, we should be able to describe their relations to each other, to what they are not, and most of all, to themselves. Plato proposes answers to most of these questions, although even he's not entirely satisfied with those answers. Many of the philosophers who followed him find them even more unsatisfactory. Notwithstanding, Plato remains firm in his commitment to the theory of forms, if only because he foresees even greater difficulties in trying to understand experience without them. So in this dialogue, we hear Socrates expressing his agreement with the older philosopher Parmenides.
If, in view of all these difficulties and others like them, a man refuses to admit that forms of things exist, or to distinguish a definite form in every case, he will have nothing on which to fix his thought, so long as he will not allow that each thing has a character that is always the same. In so doing, he will completely destroy the significance of all discourse.
In committing himself to the theory of forms, then, Plato contends that genuine knowledge, as opposed to mere opinion or belief, is indeed possible. Knowledge is possible mainly because sometimes it's indeed actual. Not only are there times when we know, but there are times when we know that we know. When we know, we are not mistaken. Once this claim is granted, the forms, in Plato's view, are required to explain it. Without them, our knowledge and the existence of what is known could not be accounted for. Philosophers since Plato, beginning with his own student, Aristotle, have almost continuously discussed and quarreled about the theory of forms, often proposing other theories to replace it. But the alternatives proposed have often had more of Plato in them than their authors would admit. This was true, for example, even of Aristotle's dissenting view, when he wondered what practical use the theory of forms had. Where the objections to Plato or Platonism are strongest, the theories proposed as replacements encounter other difficulties, almost always as serious as the objections raised in the first place. Here, too, even in opposition, philosophy after Plato has stood constantly in his shadow. Although the theory of forms has certain abstract assumptions and consequences, Plato constantly reminds us that the evidence for the existence of the forms is very much present in the world of everyday experience. The forms provide a way to understand the differences among types of knowledge and between true and false values. They also serve as a basis for pursuing some values and rejecting others. In other words, knowledge is not something apart from the decisions that human beings make. Knowledge, in fact, provides the basis for making those decisions. Nor are Plato's concepts of knowledge and reason mere abstractions or theories. The impulse for the examined life, for learning, is, according to Plato, innate in man. The urge to know is a constant feature of human nature. Even when people don't act rationally, reason is still present. It's only been prevented by other causes from expressing itself. Sometimes, as we've seen, the emotions or senses imprison reason. One memorable example of this constant presence of reason appears in Plato's concept of love or desire, in Greek, eros. If we ask, as so many people have, what love is, Plato's answer is that love is also the guise taken on by the impulse for wisdom, for philosophical knowledge. Desire, once we go below the surface of its appearance, is actually a desire for truth. At least Plato claims this in the much-admired dialogue entitled The Symposium. In The Symposium, Plato describes a festive gathering, a drinking party at which the guests, as part of the entertainment, give speeches in praise of love. These speeches form a pattern. First, Phaedrus and Pausanias speak about the relation between the lover and his beloved. For Phaedrus, the lover is to be praised most of all, since the lover is willing to sacrifice everything for love. Pausanias, on the other hand, extols the beloved as superior. He says that the beloved responds to love even when he knows that the lover may be deceitful or moved by base motives.
If anyone devotes himself to the service of another in the belief that through him he will acquire wisdom or any other virtue, this willing servitude is not base. There is no shame either in being disappointed of such hopes. But any other kind of lover's hope, whether it comes true or not, is shameful.
The physician, Eryximachus, then provides a more clinical view. Love, he reports, is the harmony between violent desires and a more divine and gentler impulse. When the gentler impulse rules, it brings true happiness and friendship.
When love brings together all the opposites, it unites them in an ordered harmony. The result is health and plenty for mankind, and for the animal and vegetable kingdoms as well.
The writer of comedies, Aristophanes, then gives a comic account of love's passion. People were first created, Aristophanes explains, as beings in whom the two sexes were combined. Soon after their creation, however, those first creatures were split in half by the gods. The result of that split now is the passion we find as each one of those halves goes around in a constant search for the other half. Aristophanes describes this view of love.
So you see, gentlemen, how far back we can trace our innate love for one another, and how this love is always trying to reintegrate our former nature, to make two into one, and to bridge the gulf between one human being and another.
The first several speeches at the party thus refer to love only between people. Agathon, who speaks next, feels that the level of the discussion needs to be raised. In his speech, then, he describes love as a god, the source of beauty and of good.
Of all gods and men, an ornament, a guide most beautiful and best.
Agathon wants here to portray love as more than human. But in order to make his point, he goes to the other extreme, presenting love as divine only and not human at all. Socrates, speaking last, must bring Agathon and the discussion down to earth, at least part of the way. So Socrates points out to the assembly that love can't be beauty or goodness in themselves. The reason for this is that love is always love of something. And that means that love could occur only when there is a need or lack which the lover wants to satisfy. The desire for something, even for beauty or good, implies that the person who has that desire does not already have that good, since if he had it, he wouldn't want it. This proves, in Socrates' view, that love can't itself be a god, since the gods lack for nothing. Socrates quotes a speech he once heard from a prophet, Diotima, about the origins of love. According to Diotima, the parents of love were need and plenty. The characters of those two parents then combine in their offspring, producing desire, which then propels love wherever it appears. So Socrates remembers Diotima's words.
As the son of plenty and need, love is always needy. Nor is he delicate and lovely, as most of us believe. But on the one hand, he is harsh and acid, always partaking of his mother's poverty. But then, too, on the other hand, he partakes of his father's plenty, in his designs upon the beautiful and the good, for he is gallant, impetuous, a mighty hunter.
Desire begins first at the level of the senses, in the body's attraction to physical beauty, but that beauty is restricted. It's an incitement for something more. Desire moves further by pursuing the beauty which is common to individual physical bodies and which is, accordingly, not itself physical. Thus, desire leads upward towards the form of beauty. A form present first in bodies, but more fully in souls and in knowledge. Finally, if the lover continues this ascent, he's rewarded with a view of beauty itself in perfect simplicity. Love, then, is distinctively human. The gods, because they have everything, don't need it. Creatures who are less than human are incapable of it. And all human beings are moved by love, whether they realize it or not. Anyone may stop at any of love's stages, including the first stage of the senses, but the desire that people experience is pointed beyond the senses, even if they don't always recognize this. The ideal of platonic love is not physical love. It's not even love of a particular person. It is love of the form of beauty, which is ideal, eternal, and real. Diotima had described to Socrates this type of love.
If man's life is even worth the living, it is when he has attained this vision of the very core of beauty. And once you have seen it, you will care nothing for the beauties that used to take your breath away and kindle such a longing in you. For then you would see true beauty face to face.
Socrates' description of love is evidence that what is human is also related to the divine. With this flourish, Socrates completes his retelling of the story that Diotima had first told him. Just when Socrates finishes speaking, the party is rudely interrupted by a number of new arrivals. Alcibiades, already drunk, enters and delivers an impromptu speech in praise of Socrates, whom he'd once tried to attract as a lover. Alcibiades lauds Socrates, especially for his ability to resist both the temptations and the weaknesses of the senses. So he shouts out,
"Fill up, Socrates, drink again! Not that you'll get any change out of him. It doesn't matter how much you give him, it never makes him drunk. It was the same when we once were in a battle together, and when we were once cut off from supplies. There was no one who put such a good face on it as he."
The party goes on, first noisily, with carousing, then gradually, as time passes, it quiets down. As with many drinking parties, some of the people fall asleep, some go home. Late in the night, Socrates is heard explaining to Aristophanes and Agathon that tragedy and comedy are closely related to each other. In fact, Socrates says the writer of tragedy will also be the writer of comedy, perhaps referring here to some of Plato's own writing. The dialogue, the symposium itself, ends as dawn breaks. Aristophanes and Agathon have also, finally, fallen asleep. Socrates alone seems unaffected by the hour or the drinking, as the narrator of the dialogue tells us.
After tucking up Aristophanes and Agathon, Socrates went on his way. He stopped at the Lyceum for a bath, and then spent the rest of the day as usual.
In this way, Socrates, known even among his friends for his homely looks, has the last word on the nature of beauty. So too, Plato and Socrates come together here, as elsewhere, in their lives and thought. Plato writes philosophical dialogues as both comedy and tragedy. Socrates, the leading figure in those dialogues, represents the life of philosophy. This philosophical life occurs between the everyday world of appearance and the world of reason or mind. Although the world of reason may sometimes be less evident than the world of appearance, it is still more real than that world. There is, quite simply, no way to avoid reason, at least for human beings. The questions raised by philosophy, Plato insists, are constantly before us, whether we want to face them or not. There's no way of escaping those questions. There's no way of putting an end to them. Not in any event, as long as we remain human rather than gods. So too, philosophy, which begins in wonder, also continues in wonder. And we are ever reminded of this by the way that Plato's dialogues lead us to ask not only Plato's questions, but our own as well.
We hope you have enjoyed this presentation of Plato by Knowledge Products. The script for this presentation is by Beryl Lang, Professor of Philosophy, State University of New York at Albany. The script is edited by John Locks of Vanderbilt University and Mike Hassel of Knowledge Products. Produced by Pat Childs. Vocal characterizations are by Rob Daniel, Travis Hardison, Cecil Jones, Bill Kolke, Paul Meyer, John Sherberg, and Robert Wynn. Music is by Ralph Childs. Recorded at Fred Jones Recording Services and Archer Productions. This material may not be copied in whole or in part without the written permission of the copyright owner. Copyright 1990 by Carmichael & Carmichael Incorporated. This presentation of The Giants of Philosophy is a part of the Audio Classics series, a continuing series of cassettes presenting the major ideas of great thinkers with a discussion of their historical and intellectual context.